This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, an interview with Dan Aykroyd.
We're so glad to see so many of your lovely people here tonight, and we would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We do sincerely hope you all enjoy the show, and please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody, everybody.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs somebody to love. Someone to love.
Someone to love.
Sweetheart.
That's the Blues Brothers, with Dan Aykroyd as Elwood Blues and John Belushi as his brother Jake. Their 1980 movie has just come out on a new 25th anniversary edition DVD. Aykroyd and Belushi created their two blue-eyed soul men for Saturday Night Live, then built two movies around them. In the second film, Jim Belushi took over the role for his late brother. Aykroyd also developed a radio show called the House of Blues Radio Hour and has a book of interviews from the program called Elwood's Blues, interviews with blues legends and stars. The Blues Brothers' success led Aykroyd to co-found the nightclub chain The House of Blues. He's busy these days opening new House of Blues clubs in several cities.
You know, people, when you do find somebody, hold that woman, hold that man, love him, please, and squeeze her, please, sir. Hold, squeeze, and please that person, give him all your love. Signify your feelings with every gentle caress. Because it's so important to have that special somebody to hold, kiss, miss, squeeze, and please.
Aykroyd has appeared in dozens of films besides the Blues Brothers, including Ghostbusters, The Coneheads, Driving Miss Daisy, Dr. Detroit, and Trading Places. Terry spoke with Dan Aykroyd last year.
How did you and Belushi start the whole Blues Brothers routine?
In 1973, John came up to Canada to recruit for the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And I was in Second City with Gilda Radner and with John Candy. And John came into Toronto, and he joined us on the set of the Second City stage, and we did an improv set. And then we went back to my very famous speakeasy called the 505, which opened after 1 o'clock after the Liquor Control Board of Ontario closed most of the bars in the province. We had a bar at the corner of Queen and River at 505 Queen Street, and all the streetcar drivers and cops from like outlying regions and waiters and waitresses and dancers would come to drink. And I had a record on by the Downchild Blues Band out of Toronto, Donnie Walsh, an incredible seminal artist out of Canada. And John, when I were listening to it, and John said, "What is this? It's a great record." I said, "Oh, it's just a local blues band. Blues, I'm from Chicago. I hear the blues now and again, but I'm into heavy metal," he says. I said, "Well, John, you show me heavy metal and I'll show you the blues." So we started to kind of talk about it and listen. And Howard Shore was there that night. He's, of course, the great Oscar-winning composer of the Lord of the Rings trilogy music. He was the original musical director on Saturday Night Live, and he was in Toronto at that time and had dropped by the bar. And he said, "Yeah, you guys should start a band, and you could call it the Blues Brothers." And we just went bink, bink. And we started to correspond. I didn't go back to New York with John. He'd managed to get Gilda to go back with him. But we kept in touch on the phone, and we started to look at material and develop material. And we did our first gig in New York in the Lone Star Cafe, and our backup band was Willie Nelson with Mickey Raphael, one of the greatest harmonica players ever. And Willie understood what we were trying to do, like so many that came along and joined us. They understood that, okay, these guys aren't the greatest musicians or singers or dancers, but what they are great front men, and they love and respect the music. So the hat and glasses are from the John Lee Hooker album House of the Blues. He wears those shades and that hat on the cover there. The suits, the black jacket and thin tie and white shirts, were because you know, a lot of artists in the 60s kind of, you know, who were progressive and maybe were getting in trouble with the law, like Lenny Bruce wanted to look straight. And so it was kind of trying to get that IRS look together to kind of fool the straights was where that came from.
When you were working doing the Blues Brothers movies or, you know, working with House of Blues or even working on Saturday Night Live, did you ever feel like in meeting some of the people who had been your idols when you were coming of age, that you were now in the position of being the man? Because because you might have been in the position of helping to, like, negotiate the deal, and they might be feeling that you weren't paying enough. And, you know, when you're negotiating deals with somebody, or when, you know, you're behind the, you know what I'm saying? So did you ever feel like suddenly you were in, like, the side that you didn't want to be on?
Well, I always felt, you know, whatever artists we ever played with or worked with or that were in the movies or records, that they never were being paid enough. And I always tried on my own to kind of supplement that. But what I felt more was that, you know, John and I, when we did the Blues Brothers, we were in existence to serve these great artists and to, you know, perhaps reintroduce them to our audience. And we always felt a great reverence for James Brown, Ray Charles, Aretha. And never felt that we were their equal, but we felt that we were really in service to their gift. And I think that's why people like Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Tom Malone and Al Rubin and Marini, you know, our great band that we had, I think that's why they joined us and they realized that we had a great reverence and respect for the music, and that's why they were so behind us. Always felt in service to these great artists, as I do feel today. Like when I was back in Chicago, we were working on, I guess it was the Blues Brothers movie. Albert Collins came in to play at Wise Fools, and he pulled up in his car, and he was unloading his amp and the drums and the amp, and I was sitting waiting for him to go on stage, and I looked at him, and nobody was helping him, and I got out there and basically was his roadie for the evening. And that was one of the most satisfying feelings I've ever had, that I could tangibly really help this man get on stage and play his music. And he didn't know who I was. He didn't know Saturday Night Live or Blues Brothers or anything. I was just a guy who was helping him to pull his equipment in out of the rain and to get on stage. And I really feel honored that I was able to do that.
What were the first records you bought? Can you remember?
Well, the first records, of course, were, you know, the Beatles and the Stones. And then I think the seminal record for me was the East-West record that Paul Butterfield did in the late 60s with Elvin Bishop and Michael Bloomfield. And from then on, I began to go out and try to search the bins in the record stores for blues artists, and then started listening to John Lee Hooker. And we had a tremendous booking agent in Ottawa, Canada, where I grew up. That's the capital of that great, great nation. And my parents worked for the government up there, and I was a kind of a son of government workers up there. And there was a club called Le Hibou, which was right on Sussex Drive near where the Prime Minister lives. And we had a booker there named Harvey Glatt, and he brought in all of the great blues stars of the age. So that as a teenager, I jammed behind Muddy Waters when S.P. Leary refused to take the drum kit. And he said, "Is anybody out there that's a drummer?" And I walked up and I started to play, and Muddy turns to me and he goes, "Keep that beat going, boy. You make Muddy feel good." I mean, this was part of my early exposure. And then I saw Paul Butterfield and Charlie Musselwhite and you know, all these great players. And it was, I guess, just through the insight of this guy who was, you know, booking for the college crowd up there. And then listening to the black radio stations in Boston and Detroit and New York. This was, you know, these were sort of all part of my exposures, I guess.
So what was in your parents' record collection? What did they listen to? And how did that affect what you liked or didn't like?
Well, my dad used to pore over the newspapers and look for record collections that were used. So he would go and he'd see that some guy in Ottawa or Hull, or where we were living there, would be selling 100 records. He'd just go out and buy them all. So we were listening to anything from Glenn Miller to Mario Lanza, lots of Broadway soundtracks and stuff. But I think my father really influenced me when he started to get into the Jack Hilton, Ray Noble, Freddie Gardner, English swing band music. That was really something, because, you know, the value of horns was there. And then Later, as I started to buy, of course, was the Beatles and the Stones and the Animals, and then the Paul Butterfield record. But my dad was into the swing band music, as many people were in Canada at that time.
Now, I read about you that you had a pretty strict Catholic upbringing, that you went to Catholic school.
Seminary.
Seminary. Well, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you're growing up in Canada. You're going mm-hmm. to a seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to blues and rock and roll and rhythm
mm-hmm.
and blues.
And seeing guys on stage in my high school imitating Mick Jagger.
Right, okay.
Imitating the Animals.
Okay, that's where I'm heading. Long before you became part of the Blues Brothers and you developed this kind of alter ego for yourself, did you mm-hmm. have a pose when you were in high school? Did you want to be black? Did you want to be a blues musician? Did you want to be somebody who you weren't and kind of take on that pose in real
sure.
life?
Sure. I wanted to be Paul Butterfield and Charlie Musselwhite, and I used to walk around in a long trench coat, a long brown trench coat with shades, and I'd slick my hair back, and I'd try to find any little band up in the bars up in the Gatineau and up in Ottawa and Hull and where I was living, and I would get on stage with them, and they'd be country bands, and I would turn to them and say, well, can you do it like this? And I would kind of show them a basic, 8, 10, 12-bar blues pattern, and then we'd just take off from there. And, of course, I was posing as Paul Butterfield. Yeah, absolutely. And then my friend Gary O'Dwyer, who is now a school principal up in Cobourg, Ontario, he was pretending to be Eric Burdon, and I had, the math whiz in class in grade 11 was pretending to be Mick Jagger, so everybody was posing, and it was all based on rock and roll and music and blues then, all of it.
Did you sing then, or I know you played drums.
I played harp mostly and sang. Yeah, the drumming was sporadic, but, I filled in for bands now and again when I was growing up.
And were you using mostly your voice, or did you almost have a persona singing voice?
Well, back then you tried to kind of imitate the people that were singing, so... You know, even today, I mean, when I sing, I try to, get down and, be someone else. You try to sing and try to, who do you love? Who do you love? I mean, of course you sing like the people that you want to emulate and people that you admire.
Ever try singing like yourself?
Well, I have a pretty, it's sort of a reedy kind of voice. This record that Jimmy Belushi and I put out last year, which mm-hmm. made it to number one on the mm-hmm. on the blues chart, Have Love Will Travel, I'm more close to my own voice on that than some of the other stuff we did as the Blues Brothers, I guess, yeah.
I do have that right here. Do you want to pick something?
The Junior Parker song, Driving Wheel. That's a good cut off that record.
My baby don't have to worry.
Dan Aykroyd, what kind of acting did you do before the Saturday Night Live era when you were still living in Canada?
Well, I did high school plays, and in college I was a stage manager with the Sock and Buskin group at Carleton University, which is a great school in Ottawa, Canada. I was a terrible stage manager because I wanted to be an actor. The producers and directors of these shows would sense that, and they kind of let me come on stage. We did Tom Paine. I played the King of France and a few other things in there. And I basically, just little stuff. Did some guerrilla theater, some Ferlinghetti and that type of stuff. Anything to kind of get out there and get involved and have fun. And I got to tell you, Terry, I mean, I have had fun. My whole life, my whole professional life has been fun. I don't think really, you know, I don't really think I can call it work. It's just been really, really fun.
Now, I read that you did some TV commercials before Saturday Night Live. Is that right?
Well, I had a production company with Dave Thomas, who, was, of course, is the genius, one of the geniuses behind SCTV. We had a radio commercial production company. And we did some radio and television commercials in, you know, in Canada when we were growing up.
Well, you know, that you've done, you did so many really funny commercial parodies on Saturday Night Live. Did you ever do the real thing? Did you ever do the equivalent of, you know, of the Bass-O-Matic or those Ronco commercials?
Yes, really? Absolutely, yeah.
you do ads for?
Well, one of my first jobs in broadcasting was working for CITY-TV. In Toronto, which was this whole new concept in urban television that really... Basically, today, your news desks across America, Channel 7, 4, or 2, wherever you want to be, network, with the graphics and the presence, the seemingly sort of active presence of the newscaster, this is from Moses Neimer's CITY-TV. He basically changed the whole format and the whole delivery of news in North America. And I worked for his station. I was a game show announcer. And I also did the shot box announcing. So I actually had to do that fast rap stuff for car companies and beer companies and all that. So sure, I was actually doing it professionally when I first started out. I was hired by none other than Ivan Reitman, who we went on to do the Ghostbusters thing together.
Wow. So you were doing the real thing before you did the parodies.
I was, yeah. I was a mailman in Toronto when I first moved there. I knew I wanted to go to Toronto, work with Lorne Michaels again. I had gone there to do a special with him when I was 19. Went back to Carleton University, couldn't concentrate, you know, had to be in show business, dropped out of school, much to the chagrin of my parents. I got a job driving mail truck in Toronto, and then I shifted to the broadcasting, and I was a shot box announcer for about a year there with City TV, and hired by Ivan Reitman, and recommended by Lauren. Lauren said, you should hire this kid. So Lauren Michaels has been instrumental in my career from, you know, basically age 17.
Let me ask about one of the parody commercials you did, and this is a terrific video compilation of some of your best sketches from Saturday Night Live, and this is the one for the Bass-O-Matic. It's like a blender that turns fish into a delicious shake.
People remember, yeah.
Tell me how you came up with this, and if it relates to a real ad that you ever did.
Oh yeah, no. My aunt, the late Hélène Goujon. She was a lovely woman. My mother's sister. She was, in fact, the Julia Child of Canada.
Really?
She had a television show and a cuisine shop in Montreal during the 60s. And I went to her house for lunch, and she was a master gourmet chef, and she was very well known she was on the network, the TV up there, and she said she was making a fish soup, and I saw she dropped the whole fish into the blender. I said, with the bones and everything, you know? She said, oh, no, don't worry, the bones. You pick the bones out like you're eating a filet. Don't worry about it. And I never forgot that. And then, you know, many years later, I was sitting with Paul Simon and Lorne Michaels and Elaine, and Chevy and John and I were there. Belushi, Simon, Paul Simon, me, Lorne, and Chevy, and we're sitting there. And, you know, and I we were just kind of laughing over things, and I was thinking about that, and, you know, we were eating a meal, and I thought, yeah, I got this idea for, you know, a scene, you know, Bass-O-Matic. And when I said that, Paul Simon, you know, who's probably one of the most brilliant people ever in entertainment, he started to really laugh, and it's hard to get Paul to laugh, you know, because he's so intellectual, so smart, you know, you got to be at a certain level. When he started to snort, I said, man, I got something. If I can make Paul laugh this easy... And I went away, and I wrote the scene based upon that night and my aunt's real experience with the fish in a blender. And I remember a woman wrote me a letter, very upset, that I would change the molecular state of the fish from solid to liquid on television. She was really, really upset about that. And I wrote her back, and I said, well, you know, this was actually the way that my aunt made fish soup.
Well, let's hear Dan Aykroyd advertising the Bass-O-Matic on Saturday Night Live.
How How many times has this happened to you? You have a bass. You're trying to find an exciting new way to prepare it for dinner. You could scale the bass, remove the bass's tail, head, and bones, and serve the fish as you would any other fish dinner. But why bother now that you can use Robco's amazing new kitchen tool, the Super Bass-O-Matic 76? Yes, fish eaters, the days of troublesome scaling, cutting, and gutting are over. Because Super Bass-O-Matic 76 is the tool that lets you use the whole bass with no fish waste without scaling, cutting, or gutting. Here's how it works. Catch a bass, remove the hook, and drop the bass. That's the whole bass into the Super Bass-O-Matic 76. Now adjust the control dial so that that bass is blended just the way you like it. Yes, it's just that simple.
Wow, that's terrific bass.
Aykroyd co-created another pair of famous brothers for Saturday Night Live, the Czech Brothers, the Wild and Crazy Guys, featuring Steve Martin as the other brother.
Ah, that Fox Barn was really something tonight. It was no difficulty to see many swinging Americans enjoying each other a great deal.
And here is a thing I will tell you. The two most swinging foxes had the huts on for us and are coming here tonight to let us hold on to their big American breasts.
Why not? There's nothing preventing them. After all, there's no other pair of Czech brothers who cruise and swing so successfully in tight slacks.
We are two wild and crazy guys.
I hope you don't mind talking about this, because I'm sure you've been asked so much. But the sketch that you did several times with Steve Martin, the Wild and Crazy Guys, the two.
I don't mind, Terry. Great. That's all right, please. I enjoy talking about these great times, and you, as an American female, should know I am no threat to you. I am so distant from you now. But if you were close to me, maybe then you might have to fear what I would do.
How did you come up with the characters?
Well, Steve had this guy called the European continental character, who was very suave and very continental. And then I had this, you know, Czech engineer who had moved to New York City and was kind of disoriented in the culture. So we blended his character and my character and came up with the Wild and Crazy Guys.
Who had you observed that inspired this character who thinks he's a real, like, American swinger?
Mostly it was guys I met in bars over here, you know? Uh-huh. The guy who told me the story about running from the tanks. You know, he was a Czech, immigrant, and he told me about running from, you know, during the Dubček era, running from the Soviet tanks. And I was just enraptured by his story here, you know? And how, as a student, he challenged the tanks and ran from the tanks. I ran from the tanks! Here I'm in New York! And, I mean, it was sort of a real swinger character that I met in a bar. So I don't know where he is now, what his name is, but he definitely was responsible for me starting to originate that character.
What did he tell you about the foxes?
His whole modus operandi was the gold chains and the polyester shirts and, you know, the whole thing about his existence was to try to get some great foxes to come home with him. And, I wasn't into the swinging scene, but I was, you know, in New York, kind of single and living at that time. And he was just one of these characters. I was just, made me agog. Why do they really exist? I mean, how could a woman even talk to this guy for more than 10 minutes? You know, you just want to run from him. But I didn't. I sat there and I pumped him for whatever he had to do. I think he was selling plumbing fixtures at the time. He was like a very sophisticated in terms of his education. He was an architect and an engineer, but he was selling plumbing fixtures, and I he was really fascinating. And I just, you know, there was one night in a bar that I met this guy, and from that, you know, you get the wild and crazy guy.
Can I ask you about the character you came up with, a Fred Garvin male prostitute?
The Fred Garvin male prostitute came solely out of, I was living in New York with Rosie Schuster, who was one of the great writers on the show, and we had a romance. We were living together as a kind of unmarried couple or whatever you want to call it. People do that in this country, don't they? We were living together, and I used to do that at home to try to as foreplay. And from
describe the character in case of any of our listeners are not.
Well, Fred Gay is a pretty straightforward guy who's got his wears his sexuality on his sleeve, ready to please a woman any way he can. But he's got certain physical infirmities that prevent him from hernias and all that kind of thing. And I would do this, and she would laugh and just, you know. And then we decided we got to write this up, so we wrote it up for Margot Kidder. So Rosie. Rosie and I wrote that together based upon us just living together and kind of laughing because, you know, I mean, you look at me. I'm not Ramon Navarro. So I made up for it with humor.
Well, it's this really funny comedy because it's like a male prostitute, but the guy looks incredibly straight and square.
Well, he wears a plaid, yeah.
He's got the plaid jacket.
Austrian hat with the glasses and sure. Absolutely. Yeah, but there's no hate. Harry, let me tell you right now, give it a whirl. Give it a whirl. Because you might enjoy what you don't see.
Did you ever laugh uncontrollably during a sketch and not, you know, and kind of lose what you're supposed to be doing?
No, I was, John and myself and Billy, we really, that was something at Second City that we were really taught not to do that because you don't want to break the integrity of the scene, and that was really important to us. And that discipline carried over into Saturday Night Live, and I was not one of the ones that broke up. I mean, later on, we used to see people do it and that, but it was something that that John and Billy and I really didn't, we didn't like it when it happened. I think during the Nerds, where I'm the fridge doctor there, and I come over and, you know, Billy's there with Gilda. They were cracking up, and I can understand why they were cracking up. But you know, it was something we prided ourselves in not doing. If we could prevent ourselves from cracking up, we really prided ourselves. And after like a scene or the show, we'd go, well, boy, it was tough to get through that one because you know the temptation was there to just laugh at your fellow performers. But I think the Second City training really, really lasted.
How did you know, like, at what point did you figure out that you could do voices?
Very early. At 3 years old, I was imitating the announcers on TV, and my dad cut off the top of a hockey stick and tied some tape around it and put a cord on the bottom and gave me a microphone when I was, you know, a fake microphone when I was 4 years old. And, you know, of course, in school... primary school and high school, I imitated all the teachers, and then I met guys who could imitate the teachers better than me, and then we sort of formed, you know, these imitation squads, and, my grade 11 math teacher, Father Paul Baxter, God rest his soul, I was not one of his favorite students. There were 10 of us that did him, and we would have, on one time, we all came dressed as him to school in the white lab coat with the little Coke bottle glasses. And like he kind of had a backward walk. He kind of wheeled back to the blackboard. And he had this voice like it was just, okay, jokers, smarten up. You know, and that's where it all really started. And there was 10 of us doing him. And he got a little amusement out of it, but didn't last long.
I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes when I'm preparing an interview, I'll read something about someone, and I'm not sure if they really said that or if it's really true, because it sometimes isn't. So let me read you something that I read that you had said, and you can tell me if it's true. And if it is true and it's too personal, you can tell me that as well. But I read that when you were 12, you were diagnosed as schizophrenic and that you had heard voices in your head and that you had to kind of keep that under control.
Well, it was more of a Tourette's thing than schizophrenia. It was analyzed as a Tourette's and Asperger's, which I still have a little bit today. I grew up being pulled one way by my mother, who was very, very strict, and then being relaxed by my father, who was very passive. And I had the Tourette's pretty badly there, and I went to a therapist about it. And at 12 years old, was able to have the luxury of sitting down with a therapist and talking through all kinds of things, books, music, and she was quite influential in kind of evening me out. Now, back then, you know, of course, now today, you know, they just give kids pills, but back then we didn't have the benefit of all the sophisticated medication, whether it works or not. I don't know. I think time will tell on that. But it was not so much. I think when I said that, I was kind of going to the extreme. It wasn't so much the schizophrenia part of it, but it was the Tourette's, Asperger's, which can be associated with hallucinogenic voices and that. And I still have a little touch of that today. I've been able to kind of defeat it without pharmaceutical medication. I just find in my research and reading today that there's a lot of people who have this kind of mild condition, and some of them get over it, and some of them it spins out where it affects them quite negatively.
If you don't mind my asking, what were some of the symptoms when you were 12, and were these things that you had to fight against to do the kind of acting
mostly,
and writing you wanted to do, or did they feed that in any way?
Well, it was mostly physical tics, you know, nervousness kind of thing, that kind of thing, and, you know, like grunting and tics and, you know, kind of the classic Tourette's type syndrome, that type of thing. But by the time I was 14, it was allayed. And I really haven't had too much occurrence, except on the Asperger's side, where I have a fascination with police, and I always have to have a badge with me. You know, there's this guy in New York who radical Asperger's. He is a guy who goes down into the subway, and he pretends to be a motorman, and he gets on the trains in uniform and drives the subway.
Really?
Well, you know, that's a radical form of Asperger's. Well, me, I have a fascination with law enforcement and the police. I guess my grandfather was a Mountie in that, so... you know, if I don't have a badge on me, I feel naked.
Well, I can't tell if you're kidding or not. I know you studied criminology when you were in college.
I did. I studied criminology. I had a great professor there. And that study of criminology really helped me when I wrote the Blues Brothers, because the Blues Brothers were classic recidivists, could never stay out of trouble, always looking for, you know, borderline sociopathic hedonists. And I wrote papers on motorcycle outlaw clubs. I wrote papers on the Detroit Mafia. I wrote papers in college. And when I came time to write the Blues Brothers, I was well armed with criminological terms and knowledge from my great professor Professor Hatt at Carleton University.
So, have you broken the law yourself outside of speeding tickets?
I was popped for marijuana possession in Marseilles, Illinois. It's so long ago now. I smoked it because I had a little problem with the back there, and I smoked it because it had the effect of adding the vasodilation to the bottom of the back. And so the cop stopped me and at a stop sign, and he said, he plucked out the bag and said, "What's this?" And I said, "Well, it's just a little pot to help me drive across country." He said, "Well, I did all these. I used to do acid." He said, "I did acid and all this. Drugs are bad. Drugs are bad." And he took me in, and we sat down, and I said, "I'd like to see what you have in your drawer." And I looked in the drawer, and they had really much better stuff than I was carrying. I said, "Can we trade?" And they said, "No." And it turned out to be quite a nice evening. I talked with the young chief of police there, and he said, "Oh, we see this stuff all the time." I said, "What's going to happen to me?" He said, "You'll get a $50 fine. You won't even have to pay it. I mean, God, you know." So I gave it up. But what was quite alarming was I was driving across country, and it was on Dan Rather that night on the CBNO, a partner of John Belushi, a pop for marijuana. And then I was so afraid and so paranoid. I kept hearing over the radio, you know, Dan Aykroyd, pop for possession of marijuana and arrested and all that. I didn't know where to go. So where do I go? I ran to Hunter Thompson's Colorado estate, and I said, Hunter, you know, and he said, forget it, you should have had speed, you'd had pills, you'd had all kinds of stuff, come on in, said, and I had a shotgun in the trunk, I had a riot shotgun, which luckily I had broken into two pieces, so when the cops searched my car, they saw I was a safe, you know, citizen and all that, and you know what, he still has that gun today, because I said, I didn't want to drive to California with that, and so he's still got that shotgun today, but otherwise, other than that, one arrest there, pretty much straight and legal.
When you became part of Saturday Night Live and you had this really talented young cast suddenly becoming famous and wealthy and having access...
Not so wealthy, no.
Not so wealthy? Okay. Okay.
No. But there was $2.75 a week.
Oh, wow.
There was no wealth on SNL.
Okay.
The wealth came later.
But still, it was kind of fame and the kind of power that fame brings, and and affairs and access to drugs, probably. I mean, you know, some people don't get through that very well, is I guess what I'm leading to. You seem to have gotten
John
through it pretty
didn't.
Well.
John didn't get through it.
Right.
And many other of my friends didn't get through it. The most valuable aspect of it was the creative satisfaction, really, being able to go out and write something and have it produced that next week. Or that, you know, or at the end of that week. That was the value of it. You know, as far as the coke and the powders and the pills, I never was much into that. As I say, I had a little smoke and that, but more, I don't know. I was focused more on the creative satisfaction of it than anything else. And you know, some of my compatriots, they were given the means to go to these extreme pleasures, and they did, and it cost them dearly. And I warned them. I warned Chris Farley, and I warned John, and I warned River Phoenix. I warned them all. I said, these are lethal substances, and you got to moderate. But these were all captains of their own ships. You can only suggest and try to influence. You can't change behavior if these people have control of their own lives and destinies and are not going to yield that control. So,
when you would warn Belushi, who was such a close friend of yours,
How about flushing vials down the toilet? How about scraping things off the dresser? How about just destroying powders? How about intercepting dealers? How about watering it down? How about trying to get them to smoke up a joint instead of do a line? Actively, Judy and I were totally and actively involved in trying to deflect, these people who wanted to serve them, these sycophants who wanted to serve them. We really took an active, and I think we kept him alive maybe longer than he might have, longer than he might have been.
And in return, would he get angry with you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, are you kidding? You flush a vial down the toilet, he'd be crazy, crazy, and then... you just have to calm him down and take him for a walk. And, a lot of babysitting there, which I'm finished with now. I ain't going to do that for anybody anymore,
How did you know then, what the right thing to do was and how far to go?
Well, the right thing, when you see these dealers, trying to please him for no money and stuff, I took people aside and said, you love this guy? You love his work? Well, don't destroy him. Come on, you want to be his friend. Keep this stuff away. And, I remember taking out the, I remember Duck Dunn when we were doing the Blues Brothers movie. Duck Dunn was the great bass player for Stax Volt. He was in our band, and he's still today one of the greatest players. We were in the alley at our club across from Second City, the old sneak joint where we had our bar, where we used to celebrate after shooting the Blues Brothers movie at night. We had so much night shift there, and a dealer came by. And Duck Dunn took out his belt to him and whipped that guy all the way to the sidewalk. And I love that. That was beautiful. Just beautiful. Because he knew the guy was coming to do John harm. That was great enforcement right there.
Must have been tough to remain really close friends with Belushi when you were heading in such different directions.
Never tough. Never. No? We were always friends. That was no problem. It was tough to put up with some of the stuff that he was, he was doing in that.
Are you writing now?
Not writing too much anymore. No, I'm only sort of focused right now on our House of Blues. We're the third largest concert business in North America now, next to Clear Channel and AEG. The radio station on 200 stations almost.
Did you ever expect this? This is what you would be doing?
I never thought that the Blues Brothers would lead to an actual tangible bricks and mortar institution. I never thought that. And I tell you, every time I walk into one of those places, I think of John.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I walk into one of those places, I say, John, man, we built this place for you. He would have loved it.
Dan Aykroyd, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Terry. I'm a great fan. And as I say, Fresh Air and your show is my favorite radio to be stopped on the New York State Thruway by troopers, too. So next time a trooper stops me, I'll say, can we stop and listen to Terry for a second? And I'll get him in the car with me.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Dan Aykroyd speaking last year with Terry Gross. A 25th anniversary edition of his film The Blues Brothers has just been released.